To change the subject, I bring up his mother and claim to really want to meet her. Nathan says,
Look, Reed, you're welcome to try, but she doesn't like what we're doing. I talked to her last night again, and I explained the whole project, and how important it is, and how much you need her. But I got nowhere.
Can't we at least talk? Say hello, you know? I almost turn and smile at Gwen now that we know Nathan deems the project important.
I doubt it. She's a tough woman, Reed. Drinks a lot, nasty temper. We're not on good terms right now.
Being the pushy investigative journalist, I decide to plow into sensitive matters. Is it because you've gotten away from the family business that you're making money with your bar?
That's kind of personal, isn't it?
Gwen scolds from the rear. Nathan takes a deep breath and glances out the side window. He grips the wheel with both hands and says,
It's a long story. But Mom has always blamed me for Gene's death, which is crazy. He was the big brother, the leader of the gang, the head chef in the meth lab. Plus, he was an addict. I was not. I used the stuff occasionally, but I never got hooked. Gene, he was out of control. This place we're going to was a run Gene made once a week. Occasionally, I tagged along. I shouldn't have been there the night we got busted. We had a guy. I won't use any names, but he was running meth for us on the west side of Bluefield. We didn't know it, but he got busted, flipped, told the DEA when and where. We walked into a trap, and I swear I could do nothing to help Gene. As I've told you, we surrendered, and they were taking us in. I heard gunshots, and Gene was dead. I've explained this to my mother 100 times, but she won't hear it. Gene was her favorite, and his death is all my fault.
Terrible, I mumble.
Did she visit you in prison?
Gwen asks sweetly from behind. Another long pause.
Twice.
Nothing is said for at least 3 miles. We're on the interstate now, headed southwest, listening to Kenny Chesney. Nathan clears his throat and says,
To tell you the truth, I'm trying to get away from my family. My mom, my cousins, a bunch of deadbeat nephews. Word's out that I own a nice bar and I'm doing okay, so it won't be long before these clowns start begging for money. I need to get farther away.
Where would you go? I ask with great sympathy.
Not far. I love the mountains, the hiking and fishing. I'm a hillbilly, Reed, and that'll never change. Boone, North Carolina is a nice place. Somewhere like that. Some place where there are no coolies in the phone book.
He laughs at this, a sad little chuckle. A few minutes later, he rocks us with,
You know, I had a buddy in prison kind of reminds me of you. Malcolm Bannister was his name. Great guy. Black dude from Winchester, Virginia. A lawyer who always said the feds got him for no reason.
I listen and nod along as if this is of no consequence whatsoever. I can almost feel Gwen seize up in the rear seat. What happened to him? I manage to ask. My mouth has never been drier.
I think Mal's still in prison. Couple more years, maybe. I've lost track. It's something. Something in the voice. Maybe the mannerisms. Something. Can't quite put my finger on it. But you remind me of Mal.
It's a big world, Nathan, I say in a deeper voice, thoroughly unconcerned. And remember, to white folks, we all look the same. He laughs, and Gwen manages an awkward laugh, too. While I was mending at Fort Carson, I worked with an expert who videoed me for hours and made a list of habits and mannerisms I had to change. I practiced for hours, but once I landed in Florida, I stopped practicing. Natural moves and habits are hard to break. My mind is frozen, and I can't think of anything to say. Gwen comes through with,
Nathan, you mentioned some nephews a few minutes ago. How long will this go on, do you think? I mean, it looks like the meth business is becoming generational for a lot of families.
Nathan frowns and considers this.
I'd say it's pretty hopeless. There are no jobs except for coal, and so many young men just don't want to work in the mines anymore. Plus, they start getting high when they're 15, hooked at 16. The girls are pregnant at 16, kids having kids, babies nobody wants. Once you start screwing, you don't stop. I don't see much future around here. Not for people like me.
I'm listening, but not hearing. My head is spinning as I wonder how much Nathan knows. How suspicious is he? What have I done to tip him off? I'm still undercover. I'm sure of it. But what's he thinking? Bluefield, West Virginia, is a town of 11,000 located on the extreme southern tip of the state, not far from the Virginia line. We skirt around it on Highway 52 and are soon on winding roads that fall and rise dramatically. Nathan knows the area well, though it's been years since he was here. We turn onto a county road and fall deeper into a valley. The asphalt ends and we zigzag along gravel and dirt roads until we stop at the edge of a creek. Old willow oaks hang overhead and block the sun. The weeds are knee-high.
Here we are,
he says, as he turns off the ignition. We get out, and I tell Slade and Cody to get their gear. We will not be using lighting, and I want the smaller handheld camera. They scramble around, grabbing equipment. Nathan walks to the edge of the creek and smiles at the bubbling water. How often did you come here? I ask.
Not much. We had several drop points around Bluefield, but this was the main one. Gene had been making runs here for 10 years, but not me. The truth was, I didn't work in the business as much as he wanted me to. I could see trouble. I tried to find other jobs, you know. I wanted out. Gene wanted me to get more involved.
Where were you parked? He turns and points, and I decide to move his truck and Slade's van to keep them out of the frame. Relying on my vast directorial skills, I want to shoot an action piece with Nathan approaching the scene on foot and the camera right behind him. We practice this for a few minutes, then begin rolling. Nathan is doing the narrative.
Louder, Nathan. You gotta be louder, I bark from the side.
Nathan is walking toward the scene and talking.
It was about 2 a.m. when we arrived here, me and Gene. We were in his truck. I was driving. As we pulled up, right about here, we could see the other vehicle over there, backed into those trees, where it should have been.
He keeps walking and pointing.
Everything appeared normal. We parked near the other vehicle, and our man, let's call him Joe. So Joe gets out and says hello. We say hello and walk to the back of Gene's truck. In a locked toolbox, there are about 10 pounds of meth. Good stuff. Most of it cooked by Gene himself. And under a sheet of plywood, there is a small cooler, also with about 10 pounds. Total drop was roughly 20 pounds, with a wholesale value close to $200,000. We got the stuff out of the truck and moved it into the trunk of Joe's car. And as soon as he slammed the trunk, all hell broke loose. There must have been a dozen DEA agents all over us. I don't know where they all came from, but they were quick. Joe disappeared, never to be seen again.
They dragged Gene over by his truck. He was cussing Joe and making all sorts of threats. Me, I was just so damn scared I could hardly breathe. They had us, dead guilty, and I knew I was headed to prison. They handcuffed me, went through my wallet, my pockets, and then led me down the trail over there. As I was walking away, I looked over my shoulder, and I could barely see Gene on the ground, with both hands behind his back. He was angry and still cussing. A few seconds later, I heard gunshots, and then I heard Gene scream when he got hit. Loudly, I say, "Cut!" and walk around in circles for a moment. "Let's do it again," I say, and we go back to the starting point. After the third take, I'm satisfied and seize upon the next idea. I ask Nathan to stand on the spot where Gene was lying the last time he saw him. We place a folding chair there, and Nathan sits down. When the camera is rolling, I ask, "Now, Nathan, what was your initial reaction when you heard gunfire?" "I couldn't believe it. They threw Gene down on the ground, and there were at least four DEA agents standing above him. His hands were already behind his back, not yet handcuffed. He had no weapon. There was a shotgun and 2 9mm in the truck. But we had not removed them. I don't care what the DEA said later. Gene was unarmed."
"But when you heard the gunshots?"
"I stopped in my tracks and yelled something like, 'What is that? What's happening?' I yelled for Gene, but the agent shoved me forward, down the trail. I couldn't look back. I was too far away. At one point I said, 'I want to see my brother,' but they just laughed and kept pushing me into the darkness. We finally got to a van and they shoved me inside. They drove me to the jail in Bluefield, and the whole time I'm asking about my brother. 'What happened to my brother? Where's Gene? What have you done with Gene?'"
"Let's cut for a minute," I say to Slade. I look at Nathan. "It's okay to show some emotion here, Nathan. Think of the people watching this film. What do you want them to feel as they listen to this awful story? Anger? Bitterness? Sadness? It's up to you to convey these feelings. So let's try it again, but this time with some emotion. Can you do it?"
"I'll try."
"Roll it, Slade. Now, Nathan, how did you first learn that your brother was dead?"
"The next morning at the jail. A deputy came in with some paperwork. I asked him about Gene, and he said, 'Your brother's dead.' Tried to run from the DEA, and they shot him down. Just like that. No sympathy. No concern. Nothing."
Nathan pauses and swallows hard. His lips begin to quiver and his eyes are moist. Behind the camera, I give him a thumbs up. He continues,
"I didn't know what to say. I was in shock. Gene didn't try to run. Gene was murdered."
He wipes a tear with the back of his hand.
"I'm sorry,"
he says softly, and the kid is really in pain. There's no acting here, just real emotion. "Cut," I say, and we take a break. Gwen rushes in with a brush and some tissue.
"Beautiful, just beautiful,"
she says. Nathan stands and walks to the creek, lost in his thoughts. I tell Slade to start rolling again. We spend 3 hours at the site, shooting and reshooting scenes that I create on the fly.
and by 1 p.m., we're hungry and tired. We find a fast food place in Bluefield and choke down burgers and fries. Riding back to Radford, the three of us are silent until I tell Gwen to call Tad Karsloff, one of my partners in Miami. Karsloff's name was mentioned by the CRS secretary when Nathan called our home office number 2 days earlier. Feigning a real conversation, Gwen says,
"Hello, Tad. It's Gwen."
"Great. You?"
"Yeah, well, we're riding back to Radford with Nathan. We spent the morning at the site where his brother was murdered. Pretty powerful stuff. Nathan did a fantastic job with narration. He doesn't need the script, it just comes natural."
I sneak a look at Nathan behind the wheel. He cannot suppress a smug little smile. Gwen continues with her one-way dialogue.
"His mother?"
A pause.
"She hasn't budged yet. Nathan says she wants no part of the film and doesn't approve. Reed wants to try again tomorrow."
A pause.
"He's thinking of going to their hometown, to film the gravesite, talk to old friends, maybe some guys he worked with, you know, that sort of thing."
A pause as she listens intently to nothing.
"Yes, things couldn't be better here. Reed is thrilled with the first 2 days, and Nathan is just wonderful to work with. Really powerful stuff. Reed says he'll call later this afternoon. Ciao."
We ride in silence for a mile or two as Nathan soaks up the praise. Finally, he says,
"So we're going to Willow Gap tomorrow?"
"Yes, but you don't have to go if you don't want to," I say. "I figure after 2 days you've had enough of this."
"So you're finished with me?"
he asks, sadly.
"Oh, no. After tomorrow, I'm going home to Miami and I'll spend a few days looking at footage. We'll begin the editing, trying to whittle things down. Then, in a couple of weeks, whenever you can work us in, we'll be back for another round of shooting."
"Have you told Nathan about Tad's idea?" Gwen says from the back seat.
"No, not yet."
"I think it's brilliant," she says.
"What is it?"
Nathan asks.
"Tad is the best editor in the company, and we collaborate on everything. Because this film involves 3 or 4 different families, different murders, he has suggested we bring you guys together. Same place, same time, and just let the cameras run. Put you all in a room in a very comfortable setting, and let the conversation begin. No script, no direction, just the facts, as brutal as they are. As I've told you, we have researched 6 cases, and they are all remarkably similar. We'll pick the best 3 or 4.
"Yours is definitely the best," Gwen interjects.
"And let you, the victims, compare stories. Tad thinks this could be beyond powerful."
"He's right," Gwen chirps. "I would love to see it."
"I tend to agree," I say.
"Where would we meet?"
Nathan says, practically on board.
"We're not that far along, but probably Miami."
"Have you been to South Beach, Nathan?"
Gwen asks.
"No?" "Oh, boy. For a single guy 30 years old, you will not want to leave. The partying is nonstop, and the girls are... How would you describe them, Reed?"
"Haven't noticed," I say on script.
"Right. Let's just say they are beautiful and hot."
"This is not about partying," I say, scolding my assistant. "We could also do it in the D.C. area, which would probably be more convenient to the families."
Nathan says nothing, but I know he's voting for South Beach. Vanessa and I spend the afternoon in a hotel room in Pulaski, Virginia, 1/2 hour southwest of Radford. We go over my notes from Fort Carson and try anxiously to figure out what made Nathan suspicious. To hear him utter the name Malcolm Bannister was chilling enough. Now we need to understand why. Malcolm pinched his nose when he was thinking. He tapped his fingers together when he listened.
He cocked his head slightly to the right when he was amused. He dipped his chin when he was skeptical. He stuck his right index finger into his right temple when he was bored with a conversation.
"Just keep your hands still and away from your face," Vanessa advises, "and speak lower."
Was my voice too high?
It tends to go back to normal when you're talking a lot. Stay quieter. Not as many words.
We argue about the seriousness of his suspicion. Vanessa is convinced Nathan is fully on board and looking forward to a trip to Miami. She is certain no one from my past could recognize me now. I tend to agree, but I'm still stunned by the reality that Nathan uttered my old name. I can almost believe he had a twinkle in his eye when he did so, as if to say, "I know who you are, and I know why you're here."
Chapter 32. Nathan insists on going with us to his hometown of Willow Gap. So for the second morning, we work our way through the mountains as he drives, and Gwen gushes about the reactions in Miami. She says to Nathan that Tad Karsloff and other important people down there in the home office watched all of our footage last night and are beyond thrilled. They simply love Nathan on camera and are convinced he is the turning point in the production of our documentary. More important, one of our major investors is visiting Miami and happened to watch the tape from Virginia. The guy is so impressed with Nathan and the entire film so far that he is willing to double down on his money. The guy's worth a bundle and thinks the movie should run at least 90 minutes. It could lead to indictments within the DEA. It could explode into a scandal like Washington has never seen. As I listen to this chatter, I am on the phone, presumably speaking with the home office, but there's no one on the other end. I grunt occasionally and say something profound, but mainly I'm just listening and brooding and acting as though the creative process can be burdensome. Sometimes I glance at Nathan. The boy is all in. Over breakfast, Gwen stressed again that I should say as little as possible, speak deeply and slowly, and keep my hands away from my face. I'm happy to let her do the talking, something she's quite good at. Jean Cooley is buried behind an abandoned country church in a small, weedy cemetery with about 100 graves. I tell Slade and Cody I want several shots of the grave and its surroundings. Then I step away for another important phone call. Nathan, now quite the actor and full of himself, suggests that he kneel beside the grave while the camera rolls, and Gwen loves the idea. I nod from a distance with the cell phone stuck to my jaw, whispering to no one. Nathan even manages to work up a few more tears, and Slade zooms in for a close-up. For the record, Willow Gap has 500 people, but you'll never find them. Downtown proper is an overgrown alley with four crumbling buildings and a country store with a post office attached to it. A few folks are moving about, and Nathan becomes nervous. He knows these people, and he does not want to be seen with a camera crew. He explains that most of the residents, including his family and friends, live out from town, off the narrow country lanes and deep in the valleys. They are suspicious people by nature, and I now understand why he wanted to accompany us. There is no school he and Jean attended. The kids from Willow Gap are bused an hour away.
"Made it easy to quit," Nathan says, almost to himself.
He reluctantly shows us a tiny, empty four-room cottage where he and Jean lived once for about a year.
"It was the last place I remember living with my father," he says. "I was about 6, I guess, so Jean was about 10.
I cajole him into sitting on the broken front steps and talking to the camera about all the places he and Jean lived. For the moment, he forgets about the glamour of acting and becomes sullen. I ask him about his father, but he wants no part of that conversation. He gets angry and barks at me, and suddenly he's acting again. A few minutes later, Gwen, very much on his side now and wary of me, tells him he's superb. As we loiter around the front of the shack, I pace as if lost in a deep creative funk. I finally ask where his mother is living now. He points and says, "About 10 minutes down that road, but we are not going there, okay?" I reluctantly agree and step away to chat on the phone again. After 2 hours in and around Willow Gap, we've seen enough. I make it known I'm not too pleased with what we've shot, and I become irritable. Gwen whispers to Nathan, "He'll get over it." "Where was Gene's meth lab?" I ask.
"It's gone," he answers. "Blew up not long after he died."
"That's just great," I mumble.
We finally load up everything and leave the area. For the second day in a row, lunch is a burger and fries just off an interstate exit. When we're on the road again, I finish another imaginary phone call and stick the phone in my pocket. I turn so I can see Gwen, and it's obvious I have big news. "Okay, here's where we are. Tad has been talking nonstop to the Alvarez family in Texas and the Marshak family in California. I mentioned these two cases to you, Nathan, if you'll recall. The Alvarez boy was shot 14 times by DEA agents. The Marshak kid was asleep in his college dorm room when they broke in and shot him before he woke up. Remember?" Nathan is nodding as he drives. "They found a cousin in the Alvarez family with good English, and he's willing to talk. Mr. Marshak has sued the DEA, and his lawyers have told him to keep quiet, but he's really pissed and wants to go public. Both can be in Miami this weekend, at our expense, of course. Both have jobs, though, so the filming has to be done on a Saturday. Two questions, Nathan. First, do you want to go and do this? And second, can you go on such short notice?"
"Have you told him about the DEA files?"
Gwen asks before he can answer. "Not yet. I just found out this morning."
"What is it?"
Nathan asks. "I think I told you our lawyers have filed the necessary paperwork to obtain copies of the DEA files on certain cases, including Gene's. Yesterday, a federal judge in Washington ruled in our favor, sort of. We can see the files, but we cannot actually have possession of them. So the DEA in D.C. is sending the files to the DEA office in Miami, and we will have access to the materials."
"When?"
Gwen asks. "As early as Monday."
"Do you want to see Gene's file, Nathan?"
Gwen asks cautiously, protectively. He doesn't answer quickly, so I chime in. "We won't be shown everything, but there will be a lot of photos, crime scene stuff and statements from all of the agents, probably a statement from the informant who set you guys up. There will be ballistics reports, the autopsy, photos of that. It could be fascinating." Nathan clenches his jaws and says,
"I'd like to see it."
"So you're in?" I ask.
"What's the downside?"
he asks, and this question gets a lot of consideration for the next few minutes. Finally, I reply, "Downside? If you are still dealing, then the DEA would come after you with a vengeance. We've had this discussion."
"I'm not dealing. I told you that."
"Then there's no downside. You're doing it for Gene and for all of the DEA's murder victims. You're doing it for justice."
"And you're gonna love South Beach,"
Gwen adds. I close the deal by saying, "We can leave tomorrow afternoon out of Roanoke, fly straight to Miami, do the shoot on Saturday, play on Sunday, see the DEA file on Monday morning, and you're home that night." Gwen says,
"I thought Nikki had the jet in Vancouver."
I reply, "He does, but it'll be here tomorrow afternoon."
"You have a jet?"
Nathan asks, and he looks at me in pure amazement. This is amusing to Gwen and me. I laugh and say,
Not mine personally, but our company leases one. We travel an awful lot, and sometimes it's the only way to get things done.
I can't leave tomorrow, Gwen says, looking at her schedule on her iPhone. I'll be in D.C., but I'll just fly down Saturday. I'm not going to miss the three families in the same room at the same time. Incredible.
What about your bar? I ask Nathan.
I own the place, he says smugly, and I got a pretty good manager. Plus, I'd like to get out of town for a few days. The bar is 10-12 hours a day, 6 days a week.
And your parole officer?
I'm free to travel. I just have to notify him, that's all.
This is exciting, Gwen says, almost squealing with delight.
Nathan is smiling like a kid at Christmas. Me, I'm all business as usual. Look, Nathan, I need to nail this down right now. If we're going, then say so. I have to call Nikki and line up the jet, and I have to call Tad so he can arrange flights for the other families. Yes or no? Without hesitation, Nathan says,
Yep, let's go.
Great. Gwen asks,
Which hotel would Nathan like, Reed?
I don't know. They're all good. Your call. I tap keys on my phone and begin another unilateral conversation.
You want to be right on the beach, Nathan, or one block off?
Where are the girls? He asks and laughs at his own incredible humor.
Okay, on the beach it is.
By the time we return to Radford, Nathan Cooley thinks he's booked into one of the coolest hotels in the world, on one of the hippest beaches, and he'll arrive there by private jet, which will only be fitting for such a serious actor. Vanessa leaves in a mad dash for Ruston, Virginia, D.C. suburbs, some 4 hours away. Her first destination is a nameless organization renting space in a rundown strip mall. It's the workshop of a group of talented forgers who can create virtually any document on the spot. They specialize in fake passports, but for the right price, they can produce college diplomas, birth certificates, marriage licenses, court orders, car titles, eviction notices, driver's licenses, credit histories. There's no limit to their mischief. Some of what they do is illegal, and some is not. They brazenly advertise on the internet, along with an astonishing number of competitors, but claim to be careful about whom they work for. I found them several weeks ago after an exhaustive search, and to validate their reliability, I sent a $500 check drawn on Skelter Films for a fake passport. It arrived in Florida a week later, and I was floored at its seeming authenticity. According to the guy on the phone, a real expert, there was an 80-20 chance the fake passport would clear customs in the event I tried to leave the country. There was a 90% chance I would be able to enter any country in the Caribbean. Problems will arise, though, if I try to re-enter the United States. I explained that this will not happen, not with my new fake passport. He explained that nowadays, in the age of terror, the U.S. Customs Service is much more concerned with who's on the no-fly list than who's fudging with phony papers. Because it's a rush job, Vanessa forks over $1,000 in cash, and they get down to business. Her forger is a nervous geek with an odd name that he reluctantly divulged. Like his colleagues, he works in a cramped, fortified cubicle with no one else in sight. The atmosphere is suspicious, as though everyone there is violating some law and half expecting a SWAT team any minute. They don't like drop-ins. They prefer the shield of the internet, so no one sees their shady business. Vanessa hands over the memory card from her camera, and on a 20-inch screen, they look at the shots of a smiling Nathan Cooley. They select one for the passport and driver's license, and go through his data, address, date of birth, and so on. Vanessa says she wants the new documents in the name of Nathaniel Coley, spelled C-O-L-E-Y, not Cooley. Whatever, the geek says. He could not care less. He is soon lost in a flurry of high-speed imaging. It takes him an hour to produce an American passport and a Virginia driver's license that would fool anyone. The passport's blue vinyl binding is sufficiently worn, and our boy Nathan, who's never traveled far, has now seen all of Europe and most of Asia. Vanessa hustles into D.C., where she picks up two first aid kits, a pistol, and some pills. At 8:30, she turns around and heads south for Roanoke. Chapter 33. The airplane is a Challenger 604, one of the finer private jets available for charter. Its cabin seats 8 comfortably and allows those under 6'2" to move around without scraping the ceiling. A new one costs something like $30 million, according to the data and specs online, but I'm not in the market. I only need a quick rental at $5,000 an hour. The charter service is out of Raleigh, and it has been paid in full with a Skelter Films check drawn on the bank in Miami. We're set for a 5 p.m. Friday departure out of Roanoke, just two passengers, Nathan and me. I spend most of Friday morning trying to convince the charter service that I will email copies of our passports as soon as I can locate mine. My story is that I have temporarily misplaced it, and I'm turning my apartment upside down. For trips outside the country, a private charter service must submit its passengers' names and copies of their passports several hours before departure. The U.S. Customs Service checks this information against its no-fly list. I know that neither Malcolm Bannister nor Max Reed Baldwin is on the list, but I don't know what might happen when Customs receives a copy of Nathaniel Coley's fake passport. So I stall, hoping and believing that the less time Customs has with both passports, the luckier I might get. Finally, I inform the charter service that I've found mine, and I kill another hour before emailing it and Nathaniel's to the office in Raleigh. I have no idea what Customs will do when it receives the copy of my passport. Quite possibly, my name will trigger an alert and the FBI will be notified. If this happens, it will be, to my knowledge, the first trace of me since I left Florida 16 days ago. I tell myself this is no big deal, because I'm neither a suspect nor a fugitive. I'm a free man who can travel anywhere without restrictions, right? But why does this scenario bother me? Because I don't trust the FBI. I drive Vanessa to the Roanoke Regional Airport, where she catches a flight to Miami through Atlanta. After I drop her off, I drive around until I find the small terminal for private aircraft. I have hours to kill, so I find a parking place and hide my little Audi between two pickup trucks. I call Nathan at his bar and deliver the bad news that our flight has been delayed. According to our pilots, there is a bug in a warning light. No big deal, but our technicians are hard at work, and we should take off around 7 p.m. The charter service emailed me a copy of our itinerary, and the Challenger is scheduled to be repositioned in Roanoke at 3 p.m. On the dot, it lands and taxis to the terminal. The adventure at hand makes me both nervous and excited. I wait half an hour before calling the charter service in Raleigh to explain that I will be delayed until approximately 7 p.m. The hours pass and I fight boredom. At 6 p.m., I stroll into the terminal, ask around, and meet one of the pilots, Devin. I turn on the charm and chat up Devin as if we're old pals. I explain that my co-passenger, Nathan, is the subject of one of my films, and we're headed off for a few days of beach fun. I don't know the kid that well. Devin asks for my passport, and I hand it over. Without being obvious, he checks my face with my photo, and all is well. I ask to take a look at the airplane. Will, the other pilot, is in the cockpit reading a newspaper as I step onto a private jet for the first time in my life. I shake his hand like a politician and comment on the stunning display of screens, switches, instruments, dials, meters, and so on. Devin shows me around. Behind the cockpit is the small kitchen, or galley, complete with microwave, a sink with hot and cold water, full bar, drawers filled with china and flatware, and a large ice bin where the beer is just waiting. I specifically asked for two brands, one with alcohol and one without. Behind one door is a collection of snacks in case we get hungry. Dinner will not be served because I do not want a flight attendant on board. The people at the charter service insisted that the aircraft's owner required the use of a flight attendant, at which time I threatened to cancel. They backed down. So it will be just Nathan and me on the trip south. The cabin is furnished with six large leather chairs and a small sofa. The decor is soft earth tones and very tasteful. The carpet is plush and spotless. There are at least three screens for movies and, as Devin goes on proudly, a surround sound system. We move from the cabin to the restroom, then the cargo hold. I'm traveling light and Devin takes my carry-on bag. I hesitate as if I've forgotten something. I have a couple of DVDs in my bag and I might need them, I explain. Can I get to it during the flight? Sure, no problem. The cargo hold is pressurized too, so you have access, Devin says. Great. I spend half an hour examining the airplane, then begin looking at my watch, as if I'm irritated at Nathan and his tardiness. This kid's from the mountains, I explain to Devin as we sit in the cabin. Doubt if he's ever been on a plane before. He's kind of rough around the edges. What kind of movie y'all doing? Devin asks. Documentary, The Meth Business in Appalachia. Devin and I return to the terminal and continue waiting. I've forgotten something in my car, and I leave the building. Minutes later, I see Nathan's new pickup truck roll into the lot. He parks quickly, then hops out, eager. He's wearing cut-off denim shorts, a pair of white Nike running shoes, no socks, a flat-billed trucker's cap, and, best of all, a pink and orange floral print Hawaiian shirt with at least the top two buttons unfastened. He grabs a stuffed Adidas gym bag from the back of his truck and bounds toward the terminal. I intercept him and we shake hands. I'm holding some papers. Sorry about the delay, I say, but the airplane is here and ready to go.
No problem.
His eyes are watery and I catch a whiff of stale beer. Wonderful. I lead him inside and to the front desk where Devin is flirting with the receptionist. I walk Nathan to the windows and point to the Challenger. That's ours, I say proudly, at least for this weekend. He gawks at the aircraft as Devin walks over. I quickly slip him Nathan's fake passport. He glances at the photo, then at Nathan, who at that moment turns from the window. I introduce him to Devin, who hands me the passport and says, "Welcome aboard." "Are we ready to go?" I ask. "Follow me," Devin says, and as we leave the terminal, I say, "Off to the beach." On board, Devin takes the Adidas gym bag and stores it in cargo, while Nathan falls into one of the leather chairs and admires his surroundings. I'm in the galley, preparing the first round of beers. The real thing for Nathan, one with no alcohol for me. When they're poured into ice-cold mugs, you can't tell the difference. I banter with Devin as he goes through the emergency procedures, nervous that he might mention our destination. He does not, and when he retires to the cockpit and straps himself in, I take a deep breath. He and Will give me the thumbs up and start the engines. "Cheers," I say to Nathan, and we tap glasses and take a gulp. I unfold a mahogany table between us.
As the jet begins to taxi, I say, "You like tequila?"
"Hell yeah,"
he replies, already the party animal. I jump up, walk into the galley, fetch a fifth of Cuervo Gold and two shot glasses, and place them hard on the table. I pour two shots, and we kill them, following them up with more beer. I have a buzz by the time we take off. When the seatbelt sign is turned off, I pour another round of beer, and we do more shots. Shots and beer. Shots and beer. I fill in the conversation gaps with drivel about the film and how excited our financial partners are at the moment. This soon bores Nathan, so I tell him we have a late dinner lined up, and one of the young ladies there is a friend of a friend who could be the hottest chick on South Beach. She's seen a portion of our footage and wants to meet Nathan.
"Did you bring any long pants?" I ask. I assume the Adidas bag is filled with clothing about as tasteful as what I'm looking at.
"Oh, yeah. Got all kinds of stuff," he says, his tongue getting thicker by the moment.
When the Cuervo Gold is half gone, I look at the navigational map on display and say,
"Only an hour to Miami. Drink up."
We knock back another shot each. Then I drain my glass of unleaded. I weigh at least 30 pounds more than Nathan. Half my drinks have no alcohol, and my vision is blurred as we pass over Savannah at 38,000 feet. He's getting bombed. I keep pouring, and he shows no signs of slacking off. As we pass high over my old stomping ground at Neptune Beach, I fix the final round. Into Nathan's beer mug, I drop two tablets of chlorohydrate, 500 milligrams each.
"Let's kill these dead soldiers," I say, slamming them onto the table, and we turn bottoms up. I take it easy, and Nathan wins the contest. 30 minutes later, he's dead to the world. I watch our progress on the screen next to the galley. We're now at 40,000. Miami is in sight, but we are not descending. I pull Nathan out of his chair and drag him to the sofa, where I stretch him out and check his pulse. I pour a cup of coffee and watch Miami fade below us. Before long, Cuba is behind us too, and Jamaica emerges at the bottom of the screen. The engines throttle back a notch, and we begin our long descent. I gulp coffee in a desperate effort to clear my head. The next 20 minutes will be crucial and chaotic. I have a plan, but so much of it is beyond my control. Nathan is breathing heavily and slowly. I shake him, but he's unconscious. From the right pocket of his too tight denim cutoffs, I remove his key ring. In addition to the one for his pickup, the collection includes six others of varying shapes and designs. I'm sure a couple fit the doors and deadbolts of his house. Perhaps a couple lock and unlock Bombays. In the left pocket, I find a neat fold of cash, about $500, and a pack of gum. From the left rear pocket, I remove his wallet, a cheap vinyl Velcro trifold that's sort of bulky. As I inventory it, I realize why. Our party boy had loaded up with 8 Trojan condoms, stored at the ready on his left buttock. There are also 10 crisp $100 bills, a valid Virginia driver's license, 2 membership cards to Bombay's, a business card for his parole officer, and one for a beer distributor. Nathan has no credit cards, probably because of his recent 5-year stint in prison and his lack of a real job. I leave the cash in place, don't touch the Trojans, and remove everything else. I substitute the fake driver's license for the valid one and give Nathaniel Coley his wallet back. Then I gently place the fake passport in his right rear pocket. He doesn't move or twitch, doesn't feel a thing.
I go to the restroom and close and lock the door. I open the cargo hold, unzip my carry-on, and remove two nylon pouches with the words "First Aid" stamped in bold letters. I stuff these into the bottom of Nathan's gym bag, then re-zip everything. I walk to the cockpit, pull back the black curtain, and lean forward to catch Devin's attention. He quickly removes his headset, and I say, "Look, this guy drank nonstop until he passed out. I can't seem to wake him up, and there's not much of a pulse. We might need some medical attention as soon as we land." Will hears this even with his headset, and for a split second, he and Devin stare at each other. If they were not descending, one of the two would probably step into the cabin and take a look at Nathan. "Okay," Devin finally says, and I return to the cabin where Nathan lies in near rigor mortis, but with a pulse. 5 minutes later, I return to the cockpit and report that he is indeed breathing, but I can't rouse him. "Idiot drank a fifth of tequila in less than 2 hours," I say, and they both shake their heads. We land in Montego Bay and taxi past a row of commercial airliners at the gates of the main concourse. To the south, I see three other jets parked at the private terminal. There are emergency vehicles with red lights flashing, all waiting for Nathan. I'll need the chaos to aid in my disappearance. I'm far from sober, but the adrenaline has kicked in, and I'm thinking clearly. When the engines are turned off, Devin jumps up and opens the door. I have my briefcase and carry-on in my chair, ready for the opportunity, but I am also hovering over Nathan. "Wait for immigration," Devin says. "Sure," I reply. Two grim-faced Jamaican immigration officers appear in the cabin and glare at me. "Passport, please," one says, and I give him my passport. He looks it over and says, "Please leave the aircraft." I hustle down the stairs, where another officer tells me to wait. Two medics board the plane, and I presume they're tending to Nathan. An ambulance backs up to the stairs, and a police car arrives with lights but no sirens. I take a step back, then another. There is a dispute about how to remove the patient from the airplane, and everyone, medics, immigration officers, police, seems to have an opinion. They finally decide against using a stretcher, so Nathan is basically dragged out and handed down the stairs. He's limp and lifeless, and if he weighed more than 140 pounds, the entire rescue would have been botched. As he's loaded into the ambulance, his gym bag appears in the door, and an immigration officer quizzes Devin about it. Devin makes sure the authorities know that the Adidas bag belongs to the unconscious one, and it is finally placed in the ambulance with him. "I need to go now," I say to the nearest officer, and he points to a door of the private terminal. I enter just as Nathan is being hauled away. My passport is stamped and my carry-on and briefcase are scanned. A customs official tells me to wait in the front lobby, and as I do, I see Devin and Will in a tense discussion with the Jamaican authorities. They probably have some tough questions for me, and I'd rather avoid them. A taxi swings through the gate and stops under the terrace outside the front door. A rear window comes down, and I see my dear Vanessa, waving frantically for me to get in. When no one is near, I leave the terminal, jump into the cab, and we speed away. She has a room in a cheap hotel 5 minutes away. From the third floor balcony, we can see the airport and the jets come and go. Lying in bed, we can hear them. We are exhausted and running on fumes. But sleep is out of the question. Chapter 34. Victor Westlake was attempting to sleep late on Saturday morning, but after the second call, he got out of bed, made the coffee,
and was contemplating a possible nap on the sofa when the third call jolted him and swept away any lingering drowsiness. It was from an assistant named Fox, who was currently keeping the Bannister-Baldwin file and waiting for something to monitor. There had not been a peep in over 2 weeks. "It came from customs," Fox was saying. "Baldwin left Roanoke yesterday afternoon on a private jet and flew to Jamaica." "A private jet?" Westlake repeated, thinking about the $150,000 in reward money and wondering how long it might last if Baldwin was burning through it.
"Yes, sir. A Challenger 604, chartered from a company in Raleigh."
Westlake thought for a moment.
"I wonder what he's doing in Roanoke."
"Odd."
"Yes, sir." "Didn't he go to Jamaica a few weeks back?
His first trip out of the country?"
"Yes, sir. He flew out of Miami to Montego Bay, spent a few days there, then went to Antigua."
"I suppose he likes the islands," Westlake said as he reached for fresh coffee. "Is he alone?"
"No, sir. He's traveling with a man named Nathaniel Coley. At least that's what's on his passport. However, it appears as though Coley is traveling with a fake passport."
Westlake sat the untouched coffee back onto the counter and began to pace around the kitchen.
"This guy got by customs with a fake passport?"
"Yes, sir. But keep in mind it was a private aircraft, and the passport was not actually examined by customs. All they had was the copy sent in by the charter service, and they checked it against the no-fly list. It's pretty routine."
"Remind me to fix that routine."
"Yes, sir."
"So the question, Fox, is what's Baldwin up to, right? Why is he chartering a private jet, and why is he traveling with a man who's using a fake passport? Can you answer these questions for me? And soon?"
"If those are my orders, yes, sir. But I'm sure I don't have to remind you how prickly the Jamaicans are."
"No, you don't."
In the war on drugs, not all battles were fought between cops and traffickers. The Jamaicans, like many police agencies in the Caribbean, had long resented the bullying from U.S. officials.
"I'll get to work," Fox said. "But it's Saturday, here and there."
"Be in my office early Monday morning with something, okay?"
"Yes, sir."
Nathan Cooley awoke in a small, windowless room, dark except for the red glow of a digital monitor on a table near him. He was lying on what appeared to be a hospital bed, narrow with railings. He looked up and saw a bag of fluids, then followed the tube all the way down to the back of his left hand, where it disappeared under the white gauze.
"Okay, I'm in a hospital."
His mouth was as dry as salt, and his head began to pound as he tried to think. He looked down and noticed the white Nike running shoes still attached to his feet. They, whoever in hell they might be, had not bothered to cover him or dress him in a patient's gown. He closed his eyes again, and slowly the fog began to lift. He remembered the shots of tequila, the endless mugs of beer, the craziness of Reed Baldwin as the two of them got smashed. He remembered having a few at his bar on Friday afternoon as he waited for his trip to the airport, then on to Miami. He must have had 10 beers and 10 shots. What an idiot. Blacked out again, and now hooked to an IV. He wanted to get up and move about, but his head was screaming, and his eyes were bleeding. "Don't move," he said to himself. There was a sound at the door, and a light came on.
A tall, very dark nurse in a pristine white outfit entered the room in mid-sentence.
All right, Mr. Coley. Time to go. Some gentlemen are here to take you.
It was English, but with an odd accent. Nathan was about to ask,
Where am I?
When three uniformed officers marched in behind the nurse and looked as though they were ready to beat him. All three were black with very dark skin.
What the hell?
Nathan managed to say as he sat up. The nurse removed the IV and disappeared, closing the door hard behind her. The older officer stepped forward and whipped out a badge.
Captain Fremont, Jamaican police, he said, just as they do on television.
Where am I?
Nathan asked. Fremont smiled, as did the two officers immediately behind him.
You don't know where you are?
Where am I?
You're in Jamaica, Montego Bay, in the hospital for now, but soon to be in the city jail.
How'd I get to Jamaica?
Nathan asked.
By private jet, and a nice one.
But I'm supposed to be in Miami, at South Beach. There's some mistake here, you see. Is this a joke or something?
Do we look like the joking type, Mr. Coley?
Nathan thought it was odd the way these people pronounced his last name.
Why did you try to enter Jamaica with a fake passport, Mr. Coley?
Nathan reached for his rear pocket and realized his wallet was missing.
Where's my wallet?
He asked.
In our custody, along with everything else.
Nathan massaged his temples and fought the urge to vomit.
Jamaica? What the hell am I doing in Jamaica?
We have some of the same questions, Mr. Coley.
Passport? What passport? I've never had a passport.
I'll show it to you later. It's a violation of Jamaican law to attempt to enter our country with a bogus passport, Mr. Coley. Under the circumstances, though, you have far more serious problems.
Where's Reed?
I'm sorry?
Reed Baldwin, the guy who brought me. Find Reed and he can explain everything.
I haven't met this Reed Baldwin.
Well, you gotta find him, okay? He's a black guy, like you all, and Reed can explain everything. I mean, we left Roanoke yesterday around 7. I guess we had too much to drink. We were headed from Miami to South Beach, where we were supposed to work on his documentary. It's about my brother Gene, you know? Anyway, there's some big mistake here. We're supposed to be in Miami.
Fremont slowly turned and looked at his two colleagues. The glances they exchanged left little doubt they were dealing with a confused and babbling moron.
Jail? Did you say jail?
Your next stop, my friend.
Nathan clutched his stomach, and his jaws filled with vomit. Fremont quickly handed him a lined waste bin, then took a step back to stay clear. Nathan puked and heaved and gasped and cursed for 5 minutes as the three officers inspected their boots or admired the ceiling.